Okay, last evening together. Is it possible for a layperson to become an arahant? If so, is it appropriate to leave the lay life? It's possible for, and this is according to the text, it's possible for a layperson to become an arahant, but even if they did become an arahant, then what they do is go off and ordain. That's how it's put in the text. Also, the function of the monastic life is just to provide the supportive conditions for having that focus on practice and training and spiritual friendship. That's an enormous support for that aspiration for liberation. Does one need permission from one's spouse to take robes? And yes, actually, that's part of the deal that the Buddha struck with his father. Do you think that a person needs to be on a long silent retreat in order to enter the stream? Not essential. Reflecting on the suttas, the vast majority that one reads about enter the stream through listening to Dhamma. That's sort of the, of course, you have to be ripe for it, and that's retreat is helpful for that. But it's through hearing the teachings, listening to Dhamma, reflecting on the Dhamma, then there's a shift. And of course, practicing the Dhamma, but then there's a shift that takes place in terms of view and perspective and being able to just step back from the habits of self, the habits of the defilements. Interesting how no self is not the same as having no free will. It's absolutely the case, in the sense that we make our choices, and that's a whole different thing than because the sense of self is a sort of an abiding, permanent sort of entity that is the kind of the core of identity. But then the sort of no self is sort of recognizing, well, it doesn't exist anyway, but there's the results of actions. That is sort of bottom line. And we have to exercise choice. And also the characteristic of, in the five khandhas, the distinguishing characteristic of sankhara, of mental formation, is volition or intention. So it's that exercising of intention or volition towards what is unwholesome, unskillful, that lands us in suffering. And it's the exercise of volition or intention that's directed towards what is mindful, what is skillful, what is discerning, that leads to peace and liberation. This is where exercising that will or that choice or that volition all the time. So we're just learning how to direct that in a skillful way. Hey, dear Rajan, I have two questions. One, when my breathing gets very fine, I notice that my head and body will subtly lean forward. Is this common? It is common because sometimes what happens, and it's sort of the reflection I gave at the mealtime, that sort of becoming. And it's on a more subtle level, but it's sort of, we're always sort of going forward. And then, of course, the body falls behind and it falls along with it. And so it's that, and so that when we're at that kind of intentness, can be watching the breath, And we can be, you know, quite settled even, but it's still not so relaxed and grounded. So then we, you know, that oftentimes leads to a sort of that moving forward, leaning into the next moment, even if it's just the subtle breath. So that's where it's helpful, that sense of checking back into the body and sort of really say, okay, how do I keep that all balanced and grounded? Okay, second question. Whenever I try mindful breathing while trying to fall asleep, I get really alert and can't fall asleep. What is your advice? Thank you. It's been such a nice, insightful retreat for me. Please reconsider doing it again next year, even if Angela Center is no longer available. Lots of gratitude. It's actually quite true. You know, sometimes that's the case where you sort of, you know, lay down mindfully on the right side, pay attention to the breath, and you know, the mind sort of brightens, and you know, why sleep? You know? So that easily happens, and sometimes it's you have to just sort of gauge the circumstance and sort of degree of freedom and flexibility that you have in the situation, and because sometimes it's really pleasant just to be. The body's very relaxed because you're lying down. It's not, and it's the end of the day, and it's a nice time to just be with the breath. And even if you're not falling asleep, it's very restful. I know for myself, not so much at Abhayagiri, because I actually tend to have more time for myself at Abhayagiri than I used to have in Thailand. And so that if I, particularly during the daytime, if I wanted to have and I usually have a kind of short midday nap, and if I lay down on my right side, I would never sort of fall asleep. It was just sort of, my mind brightened. So I would lie down on my back, relax, drop off to sleep. I didn't have that much time to do it, so to get it over with. But the circumstance was sort of part of it. But in the evening time, yeah, it's nice to just to see, because that mindfulness is also a resting. And sometimes we're quite fixated on getting our 8 hours of sleep or our whatever we think we need. You know, certainly the tendency or the standard that the forest monks that I know of encourage is, 4 to 5 hours sleep is enough. And that, if the mind is peaceful and is good concentration, you'll tend to not even need that much sleep sometimes. I mean, I've been through periods of time when I've been doing a lot of practice and then even, you know, still looking after duties and whatnot, and 3 hours of sleep and not be affected by it in the sense of it's not tiring, because the mind is bright with mindfulness. I remember meeting one monk. He was leading a group of monks on a kind of pilgrimage, and walking, so they're walking every day and usually 10 or 12 miles in a day with a group, and then find a monastery or place to spend the night and then continue. And they're going to another monastery in several provinces over. And he had just, it was at the end of the rains retreat, and he had spent the rains retreat, a 3-month rains retreat, in solitude in a cave. And he said his meditation was going so well that he was, the sort of degree of stillness in the mind was necessitated. He would rest for half an hour a day. And then he started to sort of review it and then that half an hour started to be like an indulgence. So he just stopped. And sort of the last month or month and a half of the retreat, then it just didn't bother sleeping. But the body and the mind were resting in samadhi. And then I asked him if was he still able to keep that up, or was he, now that he was out of retreat and he was actually with a group of people and out, walking and putting forth effort. And he said, and that only been, for about 10 days or so. And he said, I still don't need any sleep, but I said, I know it's impermanent. This is not going to last. And he said, it's really dependent on the samadhi. This probably seems like a silly question, but it keeps coming up. What do you think about caffeine consumption? I have a love-hate relationship with this substance, leaning towards dependency. It is so socially acceptable, but I wonder sometimes. It can have quite an effect on the mind. Thank you kindly. Yeah, that's the main thing to pay attention to, is the effect on the mind and the body. I remember one time going to visit, this was at Chithurst in England, and I was drinking decaf coffee. Hadn't been taking, there's still a bit of caffeine, but most herbal teas to me are so disinteresting. So it was decaf coffee, and then there's Anagarika Mark Sambajano. Oh. So, he loves his coffee. And he didn't realize that I'd been drinking decaf for years and years, actually. But he heard that I liked coffee, so he made this killer brew. That was awake for a long time. And I remember we were going head shaving to shave heads, and God, I thought my heart was going to stop. Kind of shaking, and I said, what was in that coffee? He said, I did a really good brew for you. So I can't deal with it. So, it has an effect. But in general, it's, it's one of the kind of stimulants that they have a, in terms of the precepts or Vinaya, then it's not really forbidden or even looked down on. It's just sort of depends on the person, depends on the, like in Chinese Buddhism, which tend to be quite refined with diet. No onions, no garlic, no leeks, no meat, no dairy. But they do a lot of tea. You'll have to pay attention to the effect that it has. And one of the reasons why I, really cut back on caffeine was I just found it wasn't as settling to the mind as I would like and find. So that nowadays I still drink tea, but it's usually green tea, and it's fairly modest consumption. So it's And then sometimes it's just, yeah, to be able to have that sort of pick me up, that this is the, get everything going again. Okay, could we get the words of the monk's reflection before eating their food? It's actually in the chanting book, if you want to. It's in... there is a, on the four requisites. So is it, so maybe check what page it's on. 36. Page 36. Yeah, so that. But yeah, that's one reflect. You know, wisely reflecting. I use alms food, not for fun, not for pleasure, not for fattening, not for beautification, only for the maintenance and nourishment of this body, for keeping it healthy, for helping with a holy life. Thinking thus, I will allay hunger without overeating. So continuing, I will live blamelessly and at ease. It's a nice reflection. Regarding generosity, it has been said that the merit one makes by giving is conditioned by the virtue of the recipients. For example, more merit to give food to a good monk than an alcoholic homeless man. How is this? There's many conditions that happen, but I mean, in terms of when one gives to somebody who is virtuous, I mean, it's just quite natural that one will feel a sense of delight and well-being in drawing close to somebody who does have virtue. There's a very different feeling when one's in proximity with, say, a well-practiced monastic as opposed to an alcoholic homeless person, which doesn't mean one shouldn't help, say, an alcoholic homeless person, but the effect is different. Mm-hmm. Also, by drawing close to, in terms of generosity or giving, that also opens a door to receiving teachings or receiving an example that then is a something that nourishes one's life, and that's part of the merit that happens. So that there's very practical reasons for making that kind of statement. I am unable at this point to wrap my understanding around no self. I feel truth in that form is not self, feeling is not self, perception, mental formations, and consciousness is not self. How can we be sure self is not hiding somewhere we haven't looked? Well, because they've been looking for over 2,500 years. so far, nothing's come up. how do I cultivate an understanding of non-self? Isn't that part of us that continually takes rebirth, self, a soul? Well, Buddhism is an extremely radical religion and philosophical teaching in that perspective of non-self. Just goes against the grain of just human experience and the even human religious experience, because there is that very, very, very deep-rooted feeling of soul, of selfhood, that is somehow separate from everything else that we experience, and that there is that continuity there. But the Buddha, he was sitting with a group of monks, and he picked up a small chip of cow dung, which is fairly common in India, and said, see how small and insignificant this piece of cow dung is? And he said, yes. And he said, if there were so much as a small insignificant bit of being that was self, then this teaching and this holy life would not be conducive to full liberation. And I said, but because that even something as small and insignificant as this piece of cow dung can't even be that much of a self anywhere, that there is a holy life that can be lived that leads to liberation. And it comes back to impermanence, because the window of experience. One of the things, say, like not even in the teachings, like impermanence, the three characteristics of existence: impermanence, unsatisfactoriness, not self. Impermanence and unsatisfactoriness can be directly experienced. Non-self has to be approached through an extrapolation, that because all this phenomena is impermanent, external, internal, coarse, refined, physical, mental, because it's all impermanent, then it can't be, nothing can be held as a self. So there's a certain extrapolation of logic that needs to be used, or because all of our experience as, again, whether physical or mental or coarse or refined, in the end, it's all unsatisfactory. It's all imperfect. It's not it's not completely perfect or completely stable, and therefore, it can't be held as a self. So there's a certain extension of logic that's needed. So it isn't as immediately experienceable, but it's a realization that one makes or understands as one looks at phenomena in these more holistic and complete ways. But that teaching of non-self is also, say, one of the reasons why Buddhism died out in India. I mean, the Buddha taught in a culture that the sort of Brahmin Hindu belief system and that sense of the Atman, the sense of self, is just so strong, and ended up being absorbed back into Indian, the Buddha's teachings ended up being absorbed back into the Indian culture that just couldn't get their mind around non-self. And there's also a social aspect, and that was a condition as well, in the sense the Buddha never really accepted the caste system. That's something that to this day is still pretty firmly in place, even with the sort of the influence of Gandhi and the independence movement, and how much they had to rely on everybody pulling together. But the caste system is still pretty embedded in the culture. So those two things, it isn't as if it's just difficult for us as, say, Westerners with Judeo-Christian background. It's difficult for even Indians, who the Buddha was their kind of son and in their culture. And in general, in human experience, I would say, it's just a natural assumption. But that's exactly why I say that Buddhism is what the Buddha taught is very, very radical, and we have to leap over some of our assumptions. But then, if you follow it through, as I said, you follow it through, you keep watching, and people have been doing it for 2,500 years, and Buddha just keeps coming up right. What is the value of generosity if someone is getting rich unlawfully and then gives part of it to charity? Karma will get you in the end. it's just how it works. And you reap the fruits of your actions, and if your actions are, say, immoral, unvirtuous, unlawful, then you'll reap the fruits of that. You'll also reap the fruits of that generosity. But they have different results, and they have a different fruit or impetus in the mind when it comes from a pure heart or a virtuous heart, as opposed from kind of a scheming. How do I get some merit out of my money that I've stashed away? But the results are different. But then also one of the things of generosity is that it's something that anybody can do. Anybody can be generous. Anybody can give. And at least that much. It's good karma. These are blessings that can come from one's life. I know people in because Thailand is a Buddhist culture, and it's 95% Buddhist, so it's an incredible juggernaut of culture behind it. Then you get a lot of different people. Supporting monasteries and being generous in different ways and within the culture as well, within the society. And oftentimes it's that generosity that opens the door to having contact with something that is better, is higher, is an opportunity to sort of say, I need to make some changes in my life. There can be a benefit arise from it, even if it doesn't come from a good intention. A person I knew who, he was attracted to kind of Ajahn Chah's charisma, and then wanted to make offerings, and it was that this is in. Ubon in the northeast of Thailand, and it was right at the time when there was still a big American Air Force base in Ubon, 5,000 to 10,000 Air Force personnel, fighter bomber base, lots of bars, and he owned a string of bars and nightclubs, and it's not a great livelihood. But he kept, if something drew him, and so he was very generous. So then he coming close to Ajahn Chah, and Ajahn Chah sort of drawing him in, and then he said, if you really want to take these, say, Buddhism seriously, you got to be keeping the precepts. And if you're making a livelihood in the way you're doing, you're never going to be able to do it. And it took him a few years. He was making good money. He was making a lot of money, and it's kind of a in the It was kind of an exciting life. He was still fairly young then. But he just kept reflecting on that and what Ajahn Chah was encouraging him. And finally he sold them all to his brother and just started a whole new livelihood, because his brother wasn't going to quit. And I remember him talking about it to me one time, and saying, you know, when I first sold my businesses and thought, I really didn't know how I was going to make a living and how to make it in a way that I could keep the precepts. But I always kept to the precepts, and those first years were quite difficult because I tried this and tried that, and this failed and that failed. But one thing I never did was compromise the precepts. And then his life really started to turn around as he continued to experiment, and so that he ended up really establishing a good livelihood that was also able to look after his family very well. He was quite... he was very happy with his life. And he was very grateful to Ajahn Chah, because without that sort of encouragement that he'd received by drawing close to him through generosity, he would never have made that change in his life. Ajahn, would it be okay with you if we take pictures tomorrow at the closing ceremony when you're receiving your gifts? Thank you for sharing your clarity and kindness with us. I think it'd be fine. I mean, it's try to be somewhat discreet. But sometimes people get right up in your face with the cameras, man. But in general, if it's sensitive to the situation, that's fine. And it'd be a nice thing. I'll probably even have Anagarika Brian doing, because he's been taking a few photos as well through this, so that we can have... We're determined to... Our website has been... for those people who've seen our website, I mean, in general, the consensus is it's a nice website. The big flaw and the disappointment is the photos. It's so hard, the way that the website's set up, it's so hard to get photos up that I think the last sort of photos we have is Tankasapo's ordination, which is like 4 years ago. It's pathetic. So that we're just, we're not going to do it that way anymore. We've got to get this, because people like to see pictures of things that we're doing and what's happening. So that, I think what we'll do, just do Picasa and have a link. And it's easy to do. Anybody can do it. And smoke block as well, yeah. So that would be able to do that. So, yeah, photos are a good thing. Ajahn, thank you for helping me get my practice out of the ditch and onto a mindful path. The retreat was the best gift I've had in many years. Thanks to all involved with the event. Metta. Yeah, I would say it came about through the offering generosity, involvement to many, many people, and it was offered as a gift. Dear Ajahn, I find the translation of Nirodha as, quote, don't make it a problem, unquote, delightful. Is there anything you might add in its relationship to dependent origination, with deep respect? It really shifts the perception of that word Nirodha, sort of that constant chasing after things to make them cease. That's tiring. And there's a certain sort of almost sort of mechanical, sort of this needs to cease and that needs to cease and that needs to cease. And then, when it's, you know, it's no longer a problem, we shift our relationship to it. And then that sense of it ceasing is not something that has to be done by us, but it just is that's its natural relationship when we see it clearly. Also, the in terms of that ceasing nirodha is the stock phrase in the suttas that describes the sort of the transition between ordinary unenlightened worldly being and the stream enterer is in Pali sort of, and it's in the Dhammacakka Sutta chant. Yang kinchi samudaya dhammang sambandhang nirodha dhammang. So that whatever is of the nature to arise, all that is of the nature to cease. And so that's that being able to, one, to see those that causal relationship, and then also that, yeah, there is this arising and ceasing. And then the ceasing is not something that one has to sort of be afraid of or grieve over or feel a separation from anything. But it's just, oh, fine, it's not a problem anymore. And there's a real release there. It has been helpful to pay attention to the gap between the out-breath and the subsequent in-breath. There feels to be a waiting or assumption that there is a next breath. The question arises, what is paid attention to after the last breath? What we start to tap into is this quality of knowing. The knowing itself is the ground that we establish our. And that's why we pay attention to the in-breath, why we pay attention to the out-breath, why we pay attention to the gaps in between. And so you're starting to get familiar with that fundamental knowing or awareness. That isn't contrived, isn't forced. It is sort of the ground of a being and the ground of the heart itself or the original mind. I mean, language is used to try to describe it. After the last breath, then there's still the knowing. That's what one pays attention to. Resting in the knowing, and that quality of confidence and clarity, even as the last breath is there. It's also why one of the reasons why samatha practice or tranquility practice is very, very helpful, because the breath really starts to slow down the body. Becomes very calm and peaceful, and the breath starts to become very calm and peaceful. And the actual breath slows down. So that sometimes, you might, because I don't know, what's the normal breath rate? 20?
18.
18? 18 to 20 a minute. It's quite ordinary, without even attaining any particularly refined states of consciousness. There might be three or four breaths a minute. As the mind starts to get more settled, the body more relaxed, sometimes there's even less. This breath comes in, and there's this long gap where you can just. Because if you go, well, I've got to get this breath going, you stir up the mind. But if there's, one isn't, one's just resting in that stillness and tranquil clarity, then whether there's a breath or not a breath, then that one's resting in that awareness or in that knowing. And then also just one of the distinguishing characteristics of the fourth jhana is that the breath actually stops. And it isn't you get the fourth jhana and die. It's you. Everything becomes so peaceful that the kind of the physical in and out breath, it's just not so necessary. It's like as Ajahn Chah said, I mean, you breathe through your pores. You don't breathe through your lungs. Your body is subtle, or it's so subtle that it's not so apparent. So that then one can rest in the knowing itself, and that of course is you're preparing for that last breath is what you're doing, so that you're not shocked or dismayed or confused. His Holiness the Dalai Lama was asked one time, what is the point of your practice, or what's the focus of your practice? And His Holiness sort of answered, I'm preparing to die. And that's that quality of being able to face that last breath without any kind of there it is. There's the last breath. Not being shaken by anything. Okay. Dhirajan Yatiko. In the cosmology of the, quote, hairball of humanity, unquote, is the cat who spit up the hairball considered a Brahma god? Just wondering. This is unanswerable. So, very compelling imagery. P.S. I prefer Jim Morrison's music.
All the connection there.
Okay. Ajahn, would you please define the khanda of perception? How does it differ from feeling and consciousness? Well, consciousness is just the function of knowing the sense object. In the sense, there's one is taking in that information. So knowledge of the feeling is the kind of the feeling tone that is associated with that sense experience. Perception is the perceiving of it, which relies on memory. We over our lifetime we gather a body of memory and we're able to have names for things and we can have a certain importance that we give to it, so that's the function of perception, in the sense that, because consciousness, all consciousness sees is like a shape, like this. I mean, consciousness sees a shape. What perception does is it perceives its color and its function. So it says, "Oh, that's a bell." But then somebody may, somebody else's perception might look at, "Oh, well, that's a nice drinking cup." So it depends on the perception. So that, and depending on the memories and associations that we have, but that's the function of perception: is memory, association, giving meaning and names to things. So we can just navigate our experience. Because if we didn't have that, then every time you went out the door, then you have to figure everything out from scratch, which is that's kind of untenable. Ajahn, I'm having a doubt attack. It. All seems too deep and unfathomable and too many eons, plus unending karma with nothing solid to hold on to. I'm overwhelmed. That's excellent. It means it's sinking in. Yeah, and you don't have to figure it out. I mean, that's something that the teachings are there, and you don't really have to figure it all out and try to get it all organized in your mind. It's just sort of that sense of, wow. Just to be able to stop the mind with that kind of, wow, that's really good. Because we continue on in our habitual programs and the ways that we react and perceive and live our lives, and we do that, and then we die, and we do it again. So that to be able to sort of have something that helps to slow that down or stop it, so we think, what the heck is this all about? And of course, the Buddha himself keeps, in terms of the cosmology and all of that, then the Buddha talks about it. But he also brings it into one doesn't need to understand the whole cosmology and all of that in order to understand the present moment experience of suffering and the cessation of suffering. So it can be, if one finds the external expression of the teachings helpful, then let's use it to either to encourage or to slow down. It's a tool to try to come back and fathom the way that we respond, react, moment by moment, to the world around us and our perceptions of our place in it. I'm sort of looking at this basket. I think everybody was getting their last questions on the last night. Okay. Ajahn, could you share a story or reflection about your young disciple Todd? I don't know if we brought any of those books with it. Anyway, it's for those who don't know, there was a book that we printed, Like a River. But Todd was a young boy. He was Thai, born in Thailand, and he was adopted by Thai parents who live up in Washington State. And he had congenital illness, thalassemia, which is really extreme anemia, so that his blood was never really healthy enough to support his body. So and there's different treatments and if it's left, he was about 9, I guess, and he came and I knew him since he was about 5, and they'd come to, he would come for treatment at the Oakland Children's Hospital twice a year. So then they'd come and stop at the monastery, and so I'd known him since he was really, really young. And he'd probably been about 7 years old that time. I was invited to go up his family lived in Pullman, Washington, sort of eastern Washington. And he knew I was coming, and he came home from school, and then he sort of ran up to see me. I'd arrive in the early afternoon. And then he, he was only a little kid, 7 years old, and he immediately sort of bows three times. And then he sort of goes into his pocket and give me this candy. And I said, "Where did you get that from?" "Oh, my teacher gave it to me. I can't remember what it was, but he sort of got a spelling right or something, and he got a candy from his teacher." And rather than eating it himself, which at a seven-year-old kid, to sort of think, "Wow, I could offer that to Ajahn Pasano when he comes this afternoon." That's kind of a story of the very, very pure-hearted. And I think he started treatment. So he was 9. I think he died when he was 10. He started a course of treatment sort of similar to like a bone marrow transplant, using stem cell. And it's a 80% success rate. He was in the 20%. So we got he just didn't really recover. But it lingered for quite a long time, and he was probably 6 months in hospital. He even started in September and he died in April. And toward the end, he knew he was dying, and he was very concerned for his parents. He woke up one morning when in the last couple of weeks, he woke up and he asked his mom, "I've been in hospital now for many months. How much allowance do I have?" And there was quite a bit of allowance to stash up. And he said, "I'd like to offer a meal at Abhay Giri." And then he also had, and there was some left over, and he had it, wanted to give it to the kids in the other kids in the ward. So he split it between the two. Very, very pure-hearted. And right in those last weeks, he woke up and he told his mom, "Oh, I had a wonderful dream." And I had all the monks I know were around my bed chanting. And his mom said, "Oh, was Ajahn Pasano there?" He said, "Yes." And he said, "What happened? Was Ajahn Anand there?" "Mom," I said, "all of them. They were all there." I have found Buddhist philosophy and meditation to be so helpful in this life. However, I am challenged by the concept of reincarnation, especially when the texts describe the hell realm, such as hungry ghosts whose throats are so narrow as a needle and cannot pass food or water, or hot realms of fire, or even the god realms of excess desire. This sounds very different from the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path. The concept of reincarnation was around before Buddhism. Can you explain how one should understand reincarnation? Is it literal or myth or what? Gratefully appreciate your words of wisdom. As I just mentioned, I mean that one doesn't need to accept the cosmology if it doesn't make sense, because the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path are sufficient within itself. Having said that, then, but there's also the, because there tends to be in the West, because it's such an unfamiliar concept, and also there tends to be a, strong predilection towards sort of psychologizing the Buddha's teachings, and certainly the Buddha. That's part of the basis of when the Buddha describes right view on a worldly level, on a conventional level, then he talks about there's giving and the fruits of giving. There's this realm and there are other realms. There is father and mother. There is so that the sense of there are these and there is this. And it's also probably good to clarify because reincarnation actually means a soul reincarnating in another body, whereas what the Buddha spoke is more like, say, like rebirth. That's the conditions that we've set in this life will be a cause as long as we're not fed up, and liberated. Then, there's the seeds of the next life, because that's what we want to do. That's where we're looking for some place to go, something to do. And just because your body dies doesn't mean that process actually comes to an end. So that, but you don't have to believe that. I mean, that's just what I believe. And again, as I say, Four Noble Truths, Eightfold Path are enough for the practice. But when you start looking and you say, well, is it just mythology? I don't think so. And I don't think the Buddha just was telling stories to keep people entertained or distract them. He was describing an aspect of experience that we also have to take into account. Those are... it's worthy of at least holding it as a doubt, or I don't know this. It seems the Buddha taught it over in many, many contexts, and was a basic. Because the Buddha pointed to the right view on a conventional worldly level is more around the karma and the fruits of karma, which includes the possibility of rebirth, right view on a transcendent level is the Four Noble Truths itself. That is the basis of, because then Because right view on a conventional level involves, say, a being, an identity, and that has consequences. Whereas right view from a transcendent level is looking at phenomena and experience without the addition of the me or the identity. It's that me that gets us in trouble. So this is quite similar, actually, but I'll read the question. As I understand Ajahn Sumedho in the Sounds of Silence and Stephen Batchelor, they do not believe in rebirth or reincarnation in literal sense. What is your belief and understanding regards this? Stephen, in particular, says this is a holdover from the society that the Buddha was born into, and not really his teaching. He also comments that the Buddha was more interested in creating a new civilization than individual enlightenment. Please comment. Well, one of the things is, and this is where it's really helpful to go back and study suttas as opposed to commentaries, as opposed to later explanations and additions, to get a feel for how the Buddha taught and what the content was of what he taught. And as one becomes familiar and steeped in the teachings, then you see, well, the Buddha was a radical, independent teacher who had a very clear overview, one, of what he was trying to do and of what liberation and the path to liberation was. And to sort of think that he would teach something just because it was, say, popular in the society, or that it was a tradition to do it. I don't think that's how his mind functioned. He was really questioned things very, very deeply, and his teaching it displays that, and that sense of creating a new civilization. I think the Buddha was not interested in a new civilization, because it didn't matter what civilization it is. It's not usually very civilized unless there's enlightened beings. So that emphasis is much more on that on path to liberation. That being said, I mean, he also understood the dynamics of human society, and he was extremely skillful and astute in being able to live within the society and bring his teaching into that society in a way that it would really transform it. And You know, many of the ways that the teaching and the say the religion, the movement of the Buddha unfolded was not random and just happenstance. The Buddha knew what he was doing. So that if one reflects on the story of the Buddha, and that he's enlightened under the Bodhi tree, and he thinks, at first he thinks, oh, what's the point of teaching? That's just going to be, nobody's going to get this. But then, of course, compassion comes in, and they say, okay, yes, I should teach. But then, you know, to teach, then you've got to actually have somebody who can listen or understand. So then you say, well, I'll teach those five ascetics who trained and lived with me, and then he has intuitive powers, and say, where are those five ascetics? Well, they're off in Sarnath near Varanasi. That's over 200 kilometers. Buddha packs up his gear, you know, and walks. You know, it's a long walk. he was putting forth the effort to do that. He arrives there. He teaches those five ascetics. They become enlightened during that period of the rainy season that he's there. People from, and in particular, a very wealthy young man with a good family comes out and listens to the teachings. And then, of course, word starts spreading. Wow, there's this really young teacher who's teaching something really fresh and new. By the end of that rainy season period, by the accounts, and there were 60 arahants. And then the Buddha, at that, the end of that time, then he said to all of them, you know, you've understood this teaching, you're independent in the teaching, you're liberated, everybody go out in a different direction. And don't go in pairs, don't go in groups, and go for the welfare and happiness of the many folk. It's just to give that as an offering to others. He said, I'm going back to Gaya Sisa, which is, it's near Bodh Gaya, but it's where, at that time, it was the most respected teacher, ascetic, in the kingdom of Magadha, which was the most powerful kingdom in India at the time. So Buddha goes there. There are three brothers within a period of, it took him probably a couple months of association and breaking through the resistance that they had. But they had a following of, with these three brothers and their following, it was about 1,000 ascetics. And that's in the fire sermon, which is one of the suttas that we chant, then it's that teaching that the Buddha gives that was the cause of their enlightenment. So this is still his first year. He's got 60 arahants out wandering teaching. Now he's got the most respected religious teacher in the sort of the the largest kingdom in India. Now he goes into Rajgir, which is the capital city of Magadha. And he goes to visit the king. Well, pretty soon he's got the king and his ministers and the kind of the retinue. So, like within a year, he's sewed up a huge network of support and momentum for his teaching to really spread through the society, so that. The Buddha was very. He knew what he was doing, and he had the barami, the accumulated virtuous qualities, to be able to do it. So that, he understood the limitations of any civilization, but he also recognized that, you can use the conventions of a society in order to enhance it or to make it a better place to live.
Ajahn, just say briefly about Ajahn Sumedho. Uh-huh. I'm not sure if, just so that people may not get the wrong understanding, I'm not sure if he would have said it quite like that. He might have said something like, just expressed ambiguity around it or... Yeah. But normally Ajahn Sumedho doesn't come down like he doesn't believe in anything. He doesn't make really kind of definite
That's true.
Statements actually. About belief about anything usually.
Because he would say, because he'll call you up on any belief.
Yeah. You say you believe in it or you don't believe in it, he'll call you up on it.
Good clarification. Okay. Following the rapture / bliss of realization of deep insight, of the sort a questioner posed last night, there inevitably seems to follow a, quote, spiritual narcissism, unquote, and other vipassana defilements. Perhaps these are the same old obstructions, just repackaged, but they seem more insidious. Any special advice or experience to share working through these? Blessings. It is interesting that when the Buddha points to, what are the defilements of insight? It's radiance, mindfulness, unremitting energy, joy. Happiness. These are the defilements of insight. and then you say, well, what are the knowledges of insight? So, it's really boring. It's knowledge of impermanence. It's knowledge of the danger. It's knowledge of dukkha. So the reason, of course, is that. Those other qualities, it's not that they don't come up. They do come up when the mind has seen something clearly or becomes very, very peaceful. But we tend to... We delight in it and we get stuck in it. Or we delight in it and, of course... we're special beings because we've got these extraordinary spiritual experiences, and just that itself is enough to bring you back down to suffering again. So that being able to see through it is the path. What is the difference between the fetter of self-view and the fetter of I am? It's a very good question because it can be quite confusing. That identifying with the the five khandhas in some way or another of, you know, say the body being self, the self being body, that sense of taking the identity of our being with an aspect of either physical or mental experience, and say that is the sort of the root or the basis or the essence of identity or selfhood, and that is that's the insight that is as where one relinquishes and on the entering the stream. So it's the beginning. So you realize, well, yeah, it can't be that way. That, you know, these body, feeling, perception, mental formations, consciousness, yeah, these are shifting, changing, poppy, unstable, and so, yeah, one, that's impossible to form a self-identity, self-view, but even with that, so there, even when that insight is there, the relinquishment, there's still the subtle sense of I am in just, you know, underlying within the mind. It's just it's more of a subtle sense of, yeah, that I am as the kind of the center point of kind of experience. So that is a much more refined and sticky defilement. So it's really not until arahantship that one's actually able to relinquish that completely. But it's much more subtle. Okay, Ajahn, what do the words gate gate para sanghate bodhiswaha mean? Words to a son I frequently sing. Many thanks. It's a mantra at the end of the Heart Sutra, which is a sort of like a core text in the wisdom teachings in the Mahayana. And I think it's a gate gate para gate para sangate bodhisattva. And it's sort of, you know, gone beyond, gone completely beyond bodhi, awakening. Svaha, I think it's sort of, so be it. Or, isn't it awesome? Yeah, that's awesome. Yeah. it's a mantra in praise of the teachings in the Heart Sutra and its efficacy. Okay, what is the funniest or story of from your own life as a monk? We humans love stories. Of course, it put me on the spot. No?
Better be funny.
There. Oh, my mind goes blank. And of course, I've related various things. And I think one of the things that makes living monastic life bearable is that you do end up having a fairly good sense of humor or a sense of irony of the kind of the nature of existence and the foibles that we have as human beings. And there, yeah. I'll leave it like that. I'm on the spot here. Is Nirodha also mean cessation? No problem. I have been using Nirodha as to note cessation of the outbreath. Is that correct? Yeah, the literal meaning of Nirodha is cessation or ending. So that using that in that way is certainly true, but it has a kind of a wider sphere of constellation of meanings, which is like, that, as I mentioned, not a problem. It's not a problem, or it's ceasing to be a problem, ceasing to be complicated. So that there's you can extend the meaning of it, but yeah, its literal meaning is cessation, and to be looking at the endings of things and the cessation of phenomena. It's a wonderful window on in practice of how to work with the mind, because of course the habit is, we're constantly moving on to the next thing, and it isn't just activity, it's the mind looking for something else to do, to become, to experience, and it's hard just to be still. Is dispassion the same as equanimity? Thank you, Ajahn, for the kindness of your generosity and patience. It is different. Dispassion is one, as I mentioned today, dispassion, also sort of viraga. It's the raga is sort of desire, passion, and so it's that settling of passion. It also has a meaning of sort of fading away or fading. Excuse me. Equanimity is a point of a balance, of serenity, of completeness, of unshakability. So on a certain level, dispassion is a causal condition, and equanimity is like a resultant condition. And of course, that's a bit too black and white, but it has that. And also, equanimity, one is a divine abiding, but then also as a tool and condition for liberation. When the Buddha teaches, say, the seven factors of enlightenment, you start mindfulness, investigation of dhammas, effort, joy, tranquility, concentration or samadhi, and the last one is equanimity. So it's like everything coming into balance. So that's the the function of equanimity, is to be able to be everything in balance, everything steady, not shaken by anything, unshakability. Not only has this Sangha practiced well, it is also questioned well. Much gratitude to you all for holding this space, and to Ajahn Pasano and what was it? Oh yeah, his crew, for an enlightening retreat. May we all grow in Dhamma for the benefit of all beings. Yes, I mean, it's been I would say you're all special. That's true. It's been a wonderful time to share with you all, and it's you know that the questions have all been great, and then just the interest is there, and sort of say when the interest level when the bar goes up, then you know the teaching. Bar of teaching goes up as well. Okay, this is a very similar question. What is the Pali word translated as dispassion? What is the relationship between dispassion and equanimity? So we just went over that. Dispassion, viraka. Raka is a desire, sensual desire, passion, sexual desire. And then we is like a negative, so non-passion, so dispassion is the English. Okay. Dear Ajahn, can you review the antidotes to the five hindrances and to the defilements? That is, loving kindness for metta, for hatred, in order to uproot the defilements, hindrance, etc. So that, say, like your say root defilements, is that sort of like that ill will, aversion. Yes, loving kindness is an antidote. It's opposite, in direct attention to that. Or desire, greed is countered by both relinquishment or renunciation as well as generosity. The delusion is countered by study of the Dhamma, hearing Dhamma. That's its antidote, is both the studying, hearing, questioning the Dhamma, so that one starts to gain a broader understanding. There's also both the hindrance and the kind of defilement of restlessness. Mindfulness of breathing is the antidote. Okay. Ajahn, I think about sharing the Dhamma with my family. I'm wondering if you have any suggestions on where to start. Has your family taken to the teaching since you've been on the path? Such gratitude. Probably the best place to start with extreme caution. And, sometimes the enthusiasm that one has may not be shared by others, and they'll either get offended or think you've just got lost it completely. So that, yeah, you have to be very, very careful in how you share the Dhamma with your family. But one of the best ways to share Dhamma with family is actually just being able to be with family and not follow one's old habits. That has a huge effect. Because I can't remember where it came from. It was really that thing. You know, it isn't as if just that family pushes your buttons. They put them there. you have to be careful. And then to not get caught in those. So that in itself is a huge way to share Dhamma with family is just being present in a way where you're not in contention, you're not complicating things with your family, so that has a really good effect. For me, my family has been quite good with accepting the what I was doing. I mean, it helped, not seeing them for 16 years. And for me, that was one of the biggest aspects of renunciation, is it? Because I have a very strong, a very loving family, I have a very good relationship with my family, and being in Thailand for all those years and not being able to, that was difficult for me, to really be able to relinquish. That being said, my brother came once when I was a young monk. My parents came to Thailand just as I became the abbot of Wat Nanachat. I was in my ninth year as a monk, so I hadn't seen them for about 10 years. And then I saw them a few years after that. They came to England for the opening of Amaravati, and I was there for the as a translator and attendant for a senior monk from Thailand, so they got to me. And my sister came to Thailand. Let's see, that had been about it was the year before I went back to Canada, so it had been about 15 years since I'd seen her. And they've all been very accepting, respectful of what I'm doing. The first time I went back to Canada, I was invited to do a 10-day retreat outside of Vancouver. And my sister really wanted to do that retreat, but she'd just been given birth to her daughter, first child. Was only 6 weeks old. My parents said, "Well, we'll come along and help out." So what actually ended up in the retreat was that my parents joined in with all the teachings and meditation. I got my dad was a bell ringer. Everybody on the retreat looked after this little baby, it was just passed around from. So that was that was wonderful, and then sort of larger family. I remember that trip then. I've got, fairly big family on both sides, lots of aunts and uncles and cousins, and I remember going to different places that we went to, and relatives would gather and want to know how I'm doing, and my parents would instruct them on how to do the meal offering, and so I'd go and I got my aunts and uncles and my grandfather and cousins, and they're putting food in my bowl at the meal offering. And then I'd go and sit down, and then I'd give a little instruction or talk, and then I'd give the blessing. I think that's atypical. but I've been very fortunate and blessed with my family. I remember one time I traveled to Canada with Ajahn Jayasaro, and I'd been back to Canada several times by that time, and I was passing through Winnipeg, and I've got a lot of relatives there as well. And some of them came, and some old friends came and listened. I was invited to give a talk, and then after the trip, we're back in Thailand, and people were asking how the trip was, and talking to the community and the monks there, and I said, "Wow, it was really gave a talk in Winnipeg, which was desolate. When I was spiritually desolate when I was there, going to university, and saying, there was a lot of people. This came to listen to the talk, and then Ajahn Jayasaro said, "Yeah, but half of them were his relatives and friends."
Yeah.
Okay, the last one. Ajahn, I realize that this question may take many lessons. What would be your advice on how to approach the study of the Abhidhamma and study and practice of the Abhidhamma? So I'll do three times. The Abhidhamma is a sort of metaphysical teachings of the Buddha. It's very organized and detailed for those who don't know what the Abhidhamma is. Ajahn Chah was once asked, what is your perspective on the Abhidhamma? And Ajahn Chah said, well, say from the Abhidhamma perspective, 1 + 1 = 2. I just say 2. you go through all these steps. It's very detailed. So that, and the forest practice tends to be, we really get back to basics and experience. And the forest tradition tends not to be very scholarly, so that the Abhidhamma doesn't play much of a role in the sort of Ajahn Chah's and the general Thai forest tradition. It is very, very important. It sort of lays a foundation for just about everything in sort of Buddhist practice in Burma and Thailand, much, much less so. Phew, okay. Gee, it's 9 o'clock. Yeah, I wanted to get through all of them. Everybody's questions are really good, so I wanted to get through them.